Hello and welcome, everyone. I am Jake Wurzak, and this is Masters of Moments. This podcast features conversations with the top entrepreneurs and business leaders around hospitality, real estate, investing, and company building. Thank you so much for joining me and enjoy the show. You've heard it on the podcast so many times, and I'm going to say it again. Relationships are everything in real estate. At Dove Hill Capital Management, one of the most interesting things about our track record is that the majority of the deals have come to us off market or lightly marketed. So we had this innovative idea a few years ago, and that was to launch the Deal Rewards Program at Dove Hill Capital Management. If you want to learn more, you can go to www.dovehillcos.com. Again, that's www.dovehillcos.com. You click on the little deal rewards icon and you can sign up. And if you have a deal that's off market that somehow came to you, maybe you're working on a deal, you're trying to put it together, bring it to us because we can help you get that deal done through our deal rewards program. We offer industry-leading incentives. We'll allow you to co-invest in the deal. We could come up with another interesting structure to allow you to do the deal with us. The Deal Rewards Program is incredibly unique and will give you an opportunity to do a deal with Dove Hill, either in a completely passive position or maybe you're taking a more active role. Either way, please check out the Deal Rewards Program at www.dovehillcos.com. Appreciate it. And this is how we've been getting our flow. The team at Wurzak Hotel Group is just firing on all cylinders right now. So I am very, very excited and proud to announce that we now have a third-party management program where we are managing hotels for other owners. We used to just manage hotels for ourselves, and now we've made some tremendous forward investments in people, our team, technology, accounting, finance, and most importantly, culture. And we are prepared to bring that out to everyone. Our team is experienced in managing independent hotels, branded hotels. We have focused heavily on boutique, lifestyle, and experiential hotels. And we're ready to manage a hotel for you. So if you are interested, if you want to learn more about what we do and how we can help your hotel, please visit wurzakhotels.com.
This is a really, really hard fundraising environment. And there are a lot of very large funds right now that are raising capital. And a lot of their capital expectations on the fundraise side are falling short. A big reason for that is just general illiquidity in the entire investor base. So if you're a high net worth investor, and you got caught up in a lot of private venture investing in 2021, well, a lot of those funds and those companies are either belly up or they're not distributing any cash. Additionally, if you were a big real estate investor and you're a high net worth investor, and maybe you're quasi-retired, you're living off your investments, a lot of real estate deals aren't trading. Some are bad, some are good, whatever it is, they're not trading. So it's hard for an investor to re-up into your deal or your fund, regardless of your track record, regardless of performance, because their personal liquidity issues are really tight. And I've heard this from multiple investors. It's not a reflection on me. It's not a reflection on you. It's the entire market has significant illiquidity. Couple positive things out there right now. The stock market has been absolutely ripping. And regardless of what happens in November, I think even if there's a correction, the stock market's going to remain positive. The other thing that seems incredibly likely is an interest rate cut. All of these things are going to loosen up investor capital. Interest rate cuts will definitely loosen up the capital on the real estate side, and a ripping stock market will make people feel wealthy and feel liquid, and then they'll be more apt to invest if they want to draw and borrow against their securities. Interest rates are going down. That'll also help that equation significantly. Many private equity groups are also just sitting on the sidelines. Blackstone is one of the very few that has made some really important investments. And actually, we have used them as kind of a guiding star to internally think about how we're going to invest, but also convey to our investors, hey, I think we're early, but now is going to be a good time. Let's look at what Blackstone's doing. They're probably the best and the smartest in the room. They're investing. We should be investing too. A lot of other funds, though, are also raising, and they're coming up against similar liquidity challenges. So they're also not investing because they don't have capital. A lot of family offices, and there's a couple categories of family offices. I think there's like three. So there's family offices where the patriarch, the matriarch, the founder had some sort of big liquidity event. They have a lot of capital and they started a family office. There's also family offices that are just legacy family businesses where they throw off a ton of ongoing cash from their existing business and they need to invest that cash. And the third family office is a very formal family office that have been around for years. Whoever set up the family office is not active or no longer with us, and they have a very programmatic investment strategy. And it's usually pretty conservative, depending on the makeup, because a lot of people are kind of like sucking off the family office to live. So they have to be kind of conservative in their investment style. I think the best family office to target in a time like this is the one where it's a business that's throwing off continuous cash flow. Like think about an oil and gas family office where this, you know, gas is continually pumping out of the ground and they have the opportunity to invest that in other deals. I think real estate-based family offices are, you know, the worst target for you in terms of thinking about raising capital, because they're always going to think that their real estate deals are better than your real estate deals. And even if they have excess capital to invest beyond their real estate deals, they're going to be incredibly picky because they're subject matter experts. And it doesn't mean you're trying to like get a bad deal by someone. It's just, it's going to be hard to win them over because they have more knowledge, right or wrong. And they are likely going to need to see the deal before investing. So they'd probably be the worst candidate for a fund. So if you're trying to raise a little fund to go out and buy a few properties, a real estate family office is probably the worst target. Now, they could be a great help to partner with you and to be JV capital. So it's important to keep them in your orbit. But I think in this environment, the best family office, if you're targeting that, is the one that's throwing off cash flow. The next category, like we talked about, is high net worth. And that's going to be hit or miss. I think it's largely driven by macroeconomic sentiment and personal liquidity issues, but you need to be talking to all of these groups. The other thing that we're seeing right now is family offices are saying two things. They're saying, one, I want to invest in credit, like debt. I want to invest in preferred equity. That's the one thing they're saying. And the second thing they're saying is, I want to do deal by deal. I don't want to do a fund. If you have a great deal, show me the deal, but I don't want to invest in just a general strategy and have you pick and choose the assets to invest in. A little bit of personal shared experience. We are in the process of raising a fund. The target of the fund is around $30 or $40 million. It's to invest in two things. One, preferred equity in hospitality and unique hospitality assets. So like really cool hotels, highly differentiated experience-based properties. For Q2, which is when we started fundraising, our goal was to close out the quarter with $10 million committed capital. That's like our first quarter of fundraising. We got to $7 million. So we were short by about 30%, but I actually still think it's pretty good because I know a lot of people that couldn't raise or raised 50% of their target. So I think that it's a great base, but it was definitely not more than we thought. It was less than we thought. So keep that in mind. It also took longer than we thought, required more meetings than might have ordinarily been the case, and definitely required some travel, meeting new investors, and required a lot of like laying the groundwork. So while we only maybe got $7 million of commitments, we might have laid the groundwork for an additional $10 to $15 million. Those people just haven't invested yet. The next thing is relationship building. So when times are tough, we're in a tough time now. It's the beginning of a new real estate cycle. We're definitely off of the last real estate cycle. You need to be relationship building and you need to be building your network. So I am meeting with existing investors. Some of them, they might not invest because maybe they're pissed because they invested in a deal in 2019. They haven't gotten their, you know, capital back. They maybe got distributions, but it's gone longer because of, you know, 10 million different things. But reconnect with all your existing investors, meet new investors. The best way to meet new investors is to like come up with a list of all the people you know with capital and just go start talking to them. And don't go there with the premise to raise capital. Go there with the premise of telling them about what you're going to be doing, what you plan to be doing, and an idea that you have. There's a saying that goes like this. If you go seeking advice, you will get capital. If you go seeking capital, you will get advice. So oftentimes going with the intro with a little bit less stress, a little bit less expectations for everyone, just say, hey, here's what I'm doing. Here's my strategy. Here's my thought. That might be a more fruitful endeavor. And you can then have follow-on investment meetings with them about the specifics, but it just takes a little bit of the edge, a little bit of the pressure off. And you may also get some great advice. Like they might give you an idea you haven't thought of. They might give you some investors you haven't thought of. And I think they'll certainly be more willing to meet with you. And one of the ways that you can approach a conversation like that is to say, hey, I know you've made a lot of private investments. I have an idea that we're pretty early on, but I'd like to talk to you about it and see if I'm, you know, thinking about it in a way that would resonate with people. Then it's like no pressure. All right, this guy isn't coming to hit me up for money. Like we're just gonna have a coffee, talk about some ideas. I found that to be really successful. The other thing you should plan to do is to have multiple meetings. It's very rare. Well, I think it's rare in this environment to just have one meeting and then get a commitment for capital. If you have a specific deal, it makes it more likely, but don't expect that on the first meeting with someone. Another thing that I like to do when I'm meeting with people is to ask them, like, who else do you know? Do you know anyone else that invests alongside of you? My experience is a lot of investors like have little investor groups. It's informal, but friends share deals amongst each other. And that's a great way to get into the network. When I first started my company, like it was impossible to raise money. Because I had no track record and had no experience. So like literally, I think we had maybe seven investors in that deal. The next deal I raised like 10 times what I did the first deal. And we had like 50 investors because everyone told their friends that they had a good experience with us and they recommended us in the second deal. So that really matters. And meeting with people continues to compound. It also is a nice way to get deal flow or to get another connection. You know, you might go seeking money and or go seeking advice and they do give you another opportunity or someone to think about. The other thing that you need to really, really, really think about is what your competitive edge is. And you should have an idea of what that is. And you can workshop that with some early investors, advisors, mentors to see if it makes sense, to see if it's compelling. But people in an environment like this need to know what your edge is. Why are you better than the next guy? The other thing when thinking about that is how you're different. Like, what are you bringing to the table to this relationship? If you're just bringing the deal like a broker, maybe that's not a lot of value. And if you are doing that, then know your role and present the deal and get compensated accordingly and structure a deal like that. We actually had a deal recently in New York that we turned down because they were looking for like OGP capital. So we went, we toured the deal. It was like two hotels. And we determined pretty quickly that the sponsor, the guy who found the deal, had like no value. He had no track record. Like, sure, he's smart, like, but like he didn't have any experience. It was really not going to add anything to the deal. So we went back to the person that kind of introed us to the deal. We're like, listen, you know, we'll pay him a fee and we'll do it that way, but we're not going to like be co-GPs with this person, give them any sort of rights because they're not going to do anything. We're going to do it all. We're going to do all the work. And we were kind of like, listen, it's actually a pretty good deal because you may make more money doing this. So like, we'll pay you a fee. You can go out and do some other deals with that money. Maybe we'll give you a little piece of the back end as well, but you won't have to do any of the hard work. So it's actually a nice proposition if that's something you're thinking about doing. And it's a great way to get started and meet people by basically giving them an opportunity. Along the same lines, why you're special. I think people want to know your story, but they want to know what you're going to bring to the deal, how you're going to do it differently, how you're going to think about it differently, what your skills are, what your track record is, what your strategy is. And lastly, why is this deal special? So here's a perfect example. Like maybe some people are on the phone, but recently I posted online, I was in Maine. I'm like, hey, I want to buy a hotel in Maine. This is a really interesting spot. I like kind of the dynamics of the setup. I'm interested to learn more. The thesis passes the test. So a couple of folks reached out. I'm like, hey, I have a deal in these five towns. And like, I looked up the guy on LinkedIn. I'm like, dude, you live in California. Like, you don't have any deal. Like, you just went on LoopNet and found five random hotels and are just sending them to me. I can do that on my own. Like, this is a waste of my time. I don't even respond to you. That is an example of, I think, what a lot of people send to investors. There's just nothing special about the deal. Find a deal that's special and focus on that one. Don't focus on 10. Focus on one. Find the one that's special. Next, I want to talk about other ways to grow your network. So we talked about existing investors and relationships. That's the easiest because if you've had a deal or two and it's gone well, then introduce me to your friends. Let's do more of it. Like that has been the way that we've raised close to $200 million is primarily through word of mouth. And if it's not through word of mouth, it was through like word of mouth that we generated on our own because we were relationship building with a group for like 3 or 4 years before they finally invested. There's also, and they're going to be less and less, but there's also kind of these funds out there. There are guys that are smart. Maybe they work for a big real estate firm. They know how to analyze. They know how to underwrite. They know kind of what markets are good. They have good networks, but they don't want to be an operator. They don't want to be a sponsor. So they kind of take a fund-of-fund approach where they're like, hey, I have this network of friends and we all kind of have a good bit of money. So I'm going to find deals. We'll put it in an SPV. I'll take a little bit of, you know, a little bit off the top for finding the deal and doing some work and doing kind of the, not asset management, but the management with the sponsor. And I like that model because it's a good way to get like $1 million, $2 million, $5 million. We've done it with kind of formal groups where they're not really friends. It's like their own investors that come and invest with this group and then this group invests with us. And then we've done it with groups that are really friends where it's just like one guy maybe has the time to put in a little bit more work than the others. And it is really his friends, but that's a great way to raise capital because you're essentially talking to one person, but you're going to raise 10x what you would have raised. So you don't have to go through talking to 10 or 20 people to then raise 10 or 20 investments. And then what that also does is those investors like tend to know you and then it expands even more. Relationships are everything in this world. So I would never go around one of those groups and try and target an investor. But, you know, things kind of just happen. You're in the orbit. They feel more comfortable. That's a great way. There's also people out there that I would describe as connectors. And one of the actually one of the guys in the community reached out and was like, hey, you know, these guys are thinking about paying me to help them raise capital for a deal. How should I structure it? How should I think about going back to them? And I also like connectors because those people are similar to a fund-of-fund model, but they're really just introducing you to people in their network or to others. And you have the direct one-on-one relationship with the investor, but it's kind of coming through this connection. That's actually better because I always like to have a direct one-on-one relationship with investors. Like if we did use a fund-of-fund kind of thing, we'll always get the individual investors like emails so we can contact them. So it doesn't really get filtered down because that's something that I'm always concerned with. But connectors are great. Couple things you have to be aware of that are really serious. Okay. You can't have an unlicensed broker sell securities for you. And when you're raising capital for a real estate deal, you are basically selling securities to investors. So in all of our deals, we file them with the SEC as an unregistered securities offering. And we have exemptions and you should get educated on that. But one of the key things is you can't pay a broker who's not a licensed broker dealer to raise capital for you on a percentage basis. Now, there's some nuances there. I'm giving you the highlights. Go do your own due diligence, but you can pay them in different ways, but you can't pay them as a percentage of what they raise. And it can't really be like a success fee. So you can't pay a guy, you know, 2% who's not a licensed broker dealer if he raises you $10 million of capital. You have to structure it in some different way. There's a variety of different ways you could do it. You could pay a flat fee. You could pay not a success fee, but some sort of other fee arrangement. Maybe it's a share of the asset management fees that that person brings in. Maybe it's a share of the ultimate promote or the profit. There's ways to get creative, but you definitely need to be careful. And, you know, you don't want to have the liability. You don't want the person that you're dealing with also to have issues or liabilities. So look up the exemptions under, I think it's Rule 506D. And also be aware of what kind of deal you sign with someone so you don't end up getting in trouble from an SEC standpoint, because that is not a good thing. A couple alternative structures around these connectors that I think will fly, but check with your lawyer, make sure that it will. You can get structured so that the incremental investment dollars that are brought in, that person gets a percentage of those added asset management fees. So let's just say this guy brought in $10 million or introduced you to people that invested $10 million, and then you also had another $10 million from somewhere else. So 50% was kind of through those introductions, 50% was on your own. So maybe of the 50% of the asset management fees, he gets a percentage of that. That could be interesting. Maybe there's a back-end component like the performance fee that could also be generated on a pro rata basis. You might want to extend it for this deal and then another deal. Eventually it should burn off and this person probably shouldn't own a piece of these investors' capital forever. So you want to be specific about the term of the engagement and how it's going to work for subsequent follow-on investments. The other way to do it is like a flat fee. You can certainly hire a capital origination person at your company and just pay them a flat fee. Obviously there's risk that they don't get anyone to invest, but you know, that's something that you need to evaluate from the outset. The other thing that's really important to keep in mind is it's very difficult to outsource fundraising. And I would say pretty much impossible to outsource fundraising if you are starting out and have a relatively small company, because every investor is going to want to speak to you. And also, you don't want someone else speaking for you unless you're just a big company and this is a super sophisticated person. It's not worth it. They're going to say something that you don't think, you don't believe. And also, no one's going to take you seriously if you don't even have the time, you're not spending the effort to sit with them, to be with them, to raise their capital. Even like I have friends with multi-billion dollar funds, some of the biggest real estate funds in the world, they still go fundraising. They still go fundraising directly. Now, they might have people that work to cultivate it where they just come in for the close. You're going to have to do the whole thing in the beginning, but individual attention is incredibly important and never going to change. So plan to spend a lot of time fundraising. From a timing standpoint, the reason why it's important to talk to people early on, not just when you have a deal, is because when you have a deal, you're going to be focused on working on the deal. You might have a tight timeline. You might be doing due diligence. And if you have to then spend time fundraising, it's going to take away from your due diligence, your whole deal process, and you might make mistakes. So it's best to build the relationships early. That way, when you have a deal, you're more talking about the deal, but you've already built the connection with the potential investor. Lastly, I want to talk about ways to overcome challenges, because all investors do is they object and they challenge you. That's it. Like, it's very rare that you're going to have investors like, oh yeah, this sounds great, let's do it. First off, you got to find a good deal. Okay. It's got to be a good deal. It has to be special. It has to be unique. In an environment where money is free and everyone's doing deals and everyone has limited capital, you don't have to find a good deal. But in times when capital's scarce and lending is scarce and people have illiquidity, you need to have a great deal. You need to have a deal that speaks to people, both from a financial standpoint. Maybe there's, you know, something else, an emotional standpoint, could be a locational standpoint. One of the things that's best to do in times of tough capital raising is to find investors that are local to the deal. So if you're raising a deal where I live in Fort Lauderdale, I would first go talk to a lot of people in Fort Lauderdale, because they know the market, they know the deal, they're going to feel more comfortable because they can go easily kick the tires. They can go, and if it's a hotel, they can go check it out. If it's a piece of land, they can go evaluate the land for themselves. It's very easy. And on an ongoing basis, they feel like they have some control, because they can always drive down the road and see this thing and make sure it's not, you know, a big Ponzi scheme, or it's not going to be a big disaster. The other thing that's incredibly important is track record. If you have a track record and it's a good or decent track record, talk about that track record and talk about how specifically that track record is going to help you make this deal that you're selling right here even better. So what did you learn from your prior deal, and what are you going to do in this deal? It's also important to be honest and share insights about what mistakes you made and how you're going to pivot and how you're going to do differently. Keep in mind, if you're talking to a new investor, like, they're not in that deal. So as long as you didn't do anything bad, if you made a mistake and you learned from it and it was a great correction, feel free to tell them it's not going to be a poor reflection on you. They're actually going to be, they're going to like that you were insightful about what worked and what didn't work. The other thing that I think is really important to do right now is to avoid construction. If you want to buy a piece of land and build something, it's going to be a lot more difficult than identifying a property that's there that you can renovate or enhance. Now, maybe half the property's there and you want to build another half, or you want to build some amenities or tweak it a little bit. But if you are building the entire thing from scratch, it is a lot harder, and it's way more harder than it was in 2021 when capital was free. So keep that in mind. The last thing that investors want to do right now is take on a ground up construction project risk. Couple shared stories. One of my friends is one of the biggest hotel developers in the country. He is trying to raise capital for two ground up construction deals in two of the best markets in the country. He is having a very difficult time doing it. He has the debt, he has the brands, he has the construction price all laid out, the GMP. He cannot get the equity right now. Is it because it's a bad deal? No. It's because the timeline of construction is a big drain on capital, and it's just more risky. And people can find great returns without having to take the extra risk on construction. Should this discourage you from doing a construction deal? Do you think it's the best deal if this is your life's passion? No. Just be aware of how hard it's going to be in terms of raising capital. It might allow you to build exactly what you want, great, and build this amazing thing, but it's going to be a lot harder to raise capital. If you can do some sort of creative financing structure and not have to pay for the land or get the land thrown in or pay for the land down the road, it's still going to be hard because you still have to do the construction. You still have the risk. So just getting the land for a discount or for free or some sort of creative structure isn't going to mitigate those other challenges that you need to think about. Another way to overcome objections if you have a limited track record is to partner with someone that does have a really good track record. And maybe that person also has some GP capital they can fund. So finding a really good JV partner. Maybe that person doesn't have any real experience, is just a smart business person, but it's a big family. It's a rich guy or gal that you can go have them back you as kind of give them some of your economics, share in some of the promote. They bring some capital into the deal and then go raise the capital from that person's network or from your own network. But that is a great way to overcome objections that you might see today. The other thing that you need to think about is debt financing for construction is incredibly scarce. Debt financing is really hard if you don't have a track record. So by bringing someone else into the deal, maybe with a bigger balance sheet or more of a track record, that might enable you to get something over the finish line that you might not ordinarily do. Another bit of shared experience is we recently bought a deal and we bought it all cash. And the deal was not hairy, but it was, let me put it this way. It would have been more expensive to finance. We wouldn't have gotten the best debt terms. We wouldn't have gotten the best interest rate. And it would have been more expensive. So we raised all the cash. We bought it all cash. And now, 4 months later, we're basically going to refinance 70% of our cash out because we realized our business plan and it allowed us to get better terms with the bank. It also took a lot of the stress off. And the other thing that it did is in Florida, insurance and a lot of other markets, insurance is a real challenge. If you buy a deal all cash, you can do whatever insurance you want. So banks have very specific requirements with how they need to insure deals. And it might be overinsured, but they don't care because you're paying for it. So by buying it all cash, it allowed us to, this is a building that like had a roof that would have caused our insurance costs to be astronomical. We bought it all cash. We ripped off the roof, put on a new roof, we're able to get cheaper insurance, and now we're able to get better debt. So that is what I wanted to, the most important thing, I almost forgot it. There must be a story. The best way to overcome an objection is with a story, okay? And the story is not you finding your dream deal. That doesn't matter. The investor we'll be happy to maybe support you on that, but that is not a story. A story is, I've been doing research in the market for 4 years. I've had this plan laid out. I've been searching for the specific piece of property and I found it. And oh, by the way, the guy that lived there, you know, died and his kids are fighting. They're selling the property. They just want cash really quick. We can get it for a big discount. That is a story. A story could also be a foreclosure. A story could be, I'm buying it from a mom and pop. They haven't renovated this inn for like 20 years. It's in an amazing location. The kids want nothing to do with the property. Parents aren't capable of running it anymore. And they want to leave it to me because they want to see someone bring it back to its glory. That is a great, and they're giving me a discount. That is a great story. Okay. So think about what your story is. Think about what your competitive edge is and make sure you can convey that to investors. And when investors give you objections, weave those new objections into your story and come out and say them the next time. So every opportunity, every time you meet with an investor, is an opportunity to like refine your pitch and to think through a new risk, think through a new objection, and then work that into your commentary going forward. We've got time for questions. We'd love to go into questions and answers on anything that I talked about or anything that you want to talk about.
So Jake, you were saying that even if like right now, if you're not raising money, you should be building relationships. So how would you go about that if you don't have a deal ready per se? Like how do you go, like how do you request that type of meeting?
Even if you don't have a specific deal, you should have a strategy or a thesis about what you want to invest in. And if you don't, you need to figure that out, because a strategy is not just like looking on LoopNet for what you think is going to be like a great deal and finding something. Well, maybe I'll do multifamily, maybe I'll do industrial, maybe I'll do office. Like, what is your overall theme? So right now with one of our strategies that we're going to be investing in the new fund is experience-based travel. So how would I describe that idea to someone so they know what I'm thinking about? We want to invest in highly differentiated assets in unique markets with high barriers to entry, with low supply and significant demand growth in drive-to destinations where we can go in and completely reimagine an existing property with a heavy emphasis on creating an experience, creating special moments and design and food and beverage for our guests. So that is what we would do in experiential investing in a highly differentiated, uncommoditized way. On the preferred equity side, so that's like, that's what it is. So that's the box. But you might say, Mark, well, I'm looking to do that in like Lake Tahoe. And here's my parameters. And we're looking to target hotels that are between, that are existing, that are between 20 and 60 rooms that were built in the 80s, that were owned by a family. And this is your story. And then when you find the deal, because you've been looking for deals that look like this, they're already going to know what your strategy is. You're just basically giving them the address and showing them the pictures. But they already know generally what that deal framework looks like. We're going to buy this hotel. We're going to renovate it. We're going to put our management team in place. We're going to, you know, load it up with social media and e-commerce marketing. We're going to take it off some of the OTAs and try and go direct booking. Now, that would apply to anything that you're doing. Now you've just found the location, the site to do it. So like we actually are doing that now, kind of. So we are, for the first time in like 20 years, we're adding a new real estate vertical to our platform. And we have a very tight focus area of what we want to do. And that's invest in Class B industrial assets that have like 15 to 13 foot high ceilings in a very specific area in East Fort Lauderdale. Like I'm talking like I can tell you street by street where it is. 1970s construction, blah, blah, blah. That is our target. So when we find a deal in that narrow target, like the investor's already made up his mind whether he likes that strategy or not. Now he just, or she needs to just hear like, all right, where is it located? You know, what are kind of the rent profile? They already know the rent profile, but like, what are the specific, you know, cash flow structures looking like here? And what's the specific strategy here? You're going to lease it up? You're going to re-tenant it? Yeah, you knew that. We already talked about that a month ago when you were here. All right. Yeah, I like it.
You're adding that strategy to the existing fund that's also doing hospitality, or that's a separate, distinct fund?
Separate, completely separate, because we only have two strategies in our new fund. One, preferred equity, and two, unique, highly differentiated hospitality assets in great markets.
Nice. Are you doing that new all under Dove Hill Capital still?
Yep, all under Dove Hill. Yep. Everything's under Dove Hill. So, but the industrial piece, we're not doing out of a fund. We're just doing deal by deal.
Gotcha.
And that, so here's the reason why, because so if you're kind of starting out-ish, we're not doing a fund because I think it's a big waste of time. In my experience, people, you know, didn't take me seriously when I was trying to raise a fund. They all wanted to invest deal by deal when I was starting. We only were able to do funds because we built up a track record, but we're basically starting from scratch on the industrial side. So the only way that I think I can raise capital effectively is deal by deal.
First, thanks for sharing the time. It's always super, super valuable. So thank you. But what is, or do you have any ideas of like common edges that rookies say that are kind of like faux pas or just bad edges that people commonly use as like their competitive advantage?
Actually, rookies use this. I think a lot of experienced managers and experienced GPs use this. Oh, you know, this property is managed by a big institutional real estate player. They're such a big organization and, you know, they've lost touch with their entrepreneurial ways and they don't run it as well as we're going to run it. In the hospitality world, I think that argument is pretty much BS because there's a lot of smart people out there in these big hotels running them. They have a lot of great systems and largely people do generally a good job. And may a smaller company be able to eke out like 2 or 3 points of margin? Yeah. But unless you're going to completely go like super entrepreneurial and like your family's going to buy the hotel and like, you know, your mom's the housekeeper, your dad's the front desk guy, and, you know, the kid's the GM or something, you're really not going to, I think, materially move the needle. Couple of good competitive edge strategies that have always resonated with me and our investors is a local advantage. Okay. So if you are local to the market, I think that gives you an advantage just because you know the market, you understand the market, you have boots on the ground. That is a big thing. I saw on Twitter the other day, some guy who's kind of starting out bought a deal in a place that's like 2,000 miles away from where he lives. And it's like kind of a small deal. I'm like, well, you know, maybe it's a good deal, but you also got to wonder, like, everyone else in that market probably passed on the deal. Like, maybe that's true, maybe it's not. But also, like, operationally, you're going to have to schlep across the country to go manage that deal because you don't have a big infrastructure. So you have no boots on the ground. So that's just going to be hard versus the assets in your market. You're probably going to go drive there more often. Another big competitive advantage I've seen is just e-commerce marketing, social media strategy. Maybe you do that very well. Maybe other people don't. And that clearly is a big competitive advantage for a lot of people. And I think a lot of people that have sold kind of micro resorts recently have generated value because of social media and because of direct bookings. The other thing that you can use as a competitive advantage is sourcing. How did you get the deal? Did you get it off market? Did you get it from your network? Did you get it from your relationships? That would be a competitive advantage versus someone maybe just going through an auction process and competing through a bid. I think another competitive advantage is track record. And that could be your track record. It could be your track record working for another company. So like these guys that used to work for, I think, Seidel Group started their own company. And part of what they would do is they would buy these kind of rundown hotels and make them really cool and fun and have great design and some cool F&B. Sure, they didn't do that with their own capital at their old firm, but they did all the work. They were involved in the curation, the creation, the design, the branding, the project management. They were involved in that. So that was a big competitive advantage that they could convey to their investors. In addition to boots on the ground, I think another competitive advantage is other properties in the market. So for example, the industrial strategy, it's very focused on a specific area. And the goal is to aggregate a lot of these properties in that specific area because it'll give us better pricing data. You know, we can sell them as a portfolio because they're all in this condensed area to make it easier for people to manage. We have economies of scale, efficiencies. I think those sorts of things exist. So for example, if you were currently owning a hotel in kind of Northern California, a competitive advantage would be owning another hotel, maybe like 20 minutes away, not because you have boots on the ground. That's a separate competitive advantage, but because you already have an infrastructure in place. You already understand the market. You already understand your customer. Other bad competitive advantages. Anything related to like you're going to work harder than the next guy. Like everyone's working hard. Okay. Everyone's working hard. You can get better debt than someone else. You can only say that if it's true. You can only say that if it's true. So on the industrial thing for us, I'm saying it because it's like a new platform and it's relevant for a lot of people starting out. We were able to get a lot better debt than other people because of our banking relationships. If we have like a huge banking relationship over all of our hotels with this one firm, they could do this little industrial deals like around the area, and we're going to get a better deal than some guy who just has one other industrial property. So that is another bad one if it's not true. Another thing that I'd be very wary of is, you know, just like doing things cheaper than someone else. You know, with the internet and with like cost efficiencies, a lot of people can do things at a good price. Unless you have a real reason why, like you own a construction company or something like that, to just say you can do it more cheaply is, you got to back it up. You got to back it up.
If you're buying a hotel and it doesn't have already an F&B component, how do you consider that in like your initial napkin math? Like, do you want the underwriting to work without the F&B and then the F&B is all just on top of that? Or
unless you're the greatest alternative restaurateur in the world, you're most likely, your F&B is, you're not going to be the moneymaker of the hotel, okay? Like maybe you'll break even, Mark knows, maybe you'll make some money. You can tell me and you can show me great examples of some of the best restaurants in the world that print money, sure. But you really want your food and beverage to draw people to the place, to be a wonderful amenity, but you're certainly going to make more money on the beverage. And depending on where you're located, it could be a break even, it could be a loss, but it could also just support the rest of the business. So like, I was coaching this one guy and he's like, well, we want to do weddings at our like micro resort. And I'm like, okay, well, what are you going to do for like a kitchen and like the banquet space? Oh, we're not really going to do that. We're like, they can have them like kind of out in the field and like they'll bring in a caterer. I'm like, that seems like a tough thing, right? I mean, sure, maybe you can make some money on that, but to have that F&B program is really going to bring people in. It's going to bring you customers that you wouldn't have already gotten on your own. We were just staying actually at a hotel in Maine. And my wife was like, you know, I feel like the F&B like offering was great, but it could have been better because it was missing this, this and that. So it's always going to be something that's going to keep guests coming back, bring new guests to your hotel. But if you let the tail wag the dog, meaning the F&B, I think you're going to have some problems because it's a very tough business, very tough business. It's harder than the hotel business. And wherever you do F&B, always try and do more B than F.
Have you seen any trend downwards on alcohol sales in the last few years?
No, but like we had a quarterly business review and I didn't think our company-wide yesterday, and I didn't think our company-wide margins on alcohol sales were as good as they should be. And, you know, there's a couple things involved in that. Maybe we're not charging enough. Maybe we are pouring too much. Maybe things are not being coded correctly. There's like a few nuances, but there's definitely not a drop off in alcohol sales. Now, I do think non-alcoholic beverages is a big thing, but that's still a beverage. So it's still going to be a B.
Do you have any recommendations on how much skin to put into a deal, like how of your own money, like that is good for investors or for yourself, or I don't know, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, the rule of thumb I would say is 10%. But the better answer is what's meaningful for you. Okay. If you're a billionaire and you're putting a deal together and you put in 50 grand, that's a joke, right? It's not meaningful. But if you're an entrepreneur, you're starting out and you put in $25,000, that might be meaningful. Okay. And that's really what investors want to know. So that is kind of the general rule of thumb. I would say around 10%, but you know, in certain deals that are really large, like maybe we've done 5%. In certain deals that are small, maybe we've done 20%. So it really just depends what's meaningful for you and what makes sense for you, because you're in the business of investing. So, you know, you have to keep some liquidity for your other properties. You have to keep some liquidity available for new investments. This is your business, whereas investors just making an investment. So it's what's meaningful. We always, in all of our memos, will show what we're putting in and tell people. Sonia, what do you got?
Hey, Jake. So if I am working on a new development deal in this market, rolling up my sleeves. It's cool. In Mexico. One thing I am figuring out is we acquired the land ourselves, our own capital. Intention is likely to roll it into the deal. What I'm trying to get an understanding of is at what level of fidelity our development plans should be at from a construction budget standpoint for us to go out and raise. Because I've heard some construction management firms say like, hey, you'll need to get to a schematic phase and then leave like a higher level of contingency. And then I've heard others say, get all the way to construction documents, lower level of contingency, make sure the same firm is doing your pre-construction quoting and your construction. Just curious, if you were to look at this from an investor's lens, what would you feel is like from the investor, best place?
Yeah, you know what I'm going to say. From an investor's lens, I want you to get it to basically 90% construction drawings. Mm-hmm. So, and essentially you want a GMP. Now, if you could even get 100% of your construction drawings, by the way, never 100%. So you can get it to 95%, a GMP and full design. When I say 95, I'm including design and furniture and all that stuff. Okay. Mm-hmm. Because we're building a property right now and we had 10% contingency. Hotels will open in 2 weeks. We have a partner on the deal. We're like maybe 35% and they're the balance. So they were a little bit more driving the ship and we were a little bit more willing to let them do it. The interior design drawings were not fully baked by the time we did the GMP. And I was like, this is just dumb. Like, this is dumb. Now we needed to get the loan going. We had a tight timeline. We had to push very sophisticated developers and people on both sides. But like, I was not excited about doing that. Now we had enough allowances based on all of our experience. We were able to figure it out. But the best way is to have all your costs in order. Why? Because if you don't, and then you raise like $10 million or let's just say you raise $2 million, then you have to go back and raise like another $2 million. And it's not because you're doubling the size of your property. You're going to have some tough conversations with investors because they're effectively getting, you know, kind of diluted. Like, you know, maybe they own 50% and now they're going to own 25%. So I would prefer to see you take this thing to the finish line. And then whether you're raising from high net worth investors or, you know, sophisticated group or family office or whatever, then we would do it. It's also an advantage. Like, I wouldn't invest in a deal in a traditional way that's at the phase that you're in. I would rather wait. You do all the time and work, and then I'm going to invest when we're ready to go. We did that at the Moxie in St. Pete. We invested at the end. Now, we built hotels ourselves and invested in the beginning and doing exactly what you're doing. So definitely can be done 100%. But that's why I think it might be worth exploring different structures. So maybe for your investors that are willing to take the risk of getting through the pre-development process, maybe you don't charge them a promote, or maybe you do charge them a promote, but you let them invest at your land basis. So if you bought the land for $100,000, let them invest at that valuation. They pay for the soft costs. And then once you've already created this value, you have the plans together, you know, maybe you've spent $300,000, but you kind of mark it up to $500,000 because you're ready to go, but your original investor still invested kind of at that cost basis.
Mm-hmm. So stage on your end, if you are saying you're at like a 95%, how much are you leaving for contingency at that point?
Well, I think construction is always a little crazy. So I would leave at minimum 5%. Mm-hmm. And we are not doing any renovation project today without 10% contingency. So new construction is a lot more predictable, but we're not doing any renovation today without at least 10% contingency. Mm-hmm. And that's total cost. So it's not just of your hard cost, that's of everything.
And on the interior side, are you, when you're saying you're getting to a higher level of fidelity there and locking things in, like, are you at the level that you know exactly everything you would be procuring, like all the SKUs, furniture, et cetera, or just like the cost of the finishes and like the budget per interior per room with some ideas of the materials you'd be using?
I would like to have everything. Now, that doesn't mean though, okay, that you need to delay your whole construction project, pick, you know, what fabric you want on this sofa in the lobby, okay? Like, you can make an allowance for that. You can figure that out. Whether you're procuring yourself or you're going to work with a purchasing agent, like, you can make estimates. You know, you can count up all the furniture in the lobby and assume, all right, you know, each chair is going to cost $500. Each table is going to cost $2,000. Like, you could figure it out.
Yeah.
That's what I would do. But in terms of finishes, like hard interior finishes, 100% you need to have those done.
Yeah. Makes sense.
100%. And you know, we even did like kind of a back of napkin-ish on a recent renovation project where it's like, count up all the pieces of furniture. There was 100 pieces of furniture in the lobby or something. And we're like, all right, let's just say each one costs $1,000. Each one doesn't cost $1,000 because you have a $1,000 chair, but then you have like a $200 side table. So let's see. Okay, it's $100,000. All right. I know worst case scenario, it's $100,000. But I can tell you though, in one recent deal, our partner was like, listen, we don't want to do anything. We don't want to approve you guys to do anything until you have every single thing costed out. So we said, okay. So we costed out every single thing. Now, again, did we, you know, if there was like art on the wall, we would left an allowance, like $300 a picture or something like that. But yeah, each furniture was bid out and costed with fabric, with everything. And you just start a project then with a lot more comfort and you just feel good. It's nice. Mm-hmm. It sucks having to dip into contingency and like figure things out along the way. It's really great to come in under budget. So mm-hmm. I'd try and set yourself up to do that from the start.
Yeah. So I guess rookie competitive advantage is also I've done all the work.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. No. You're investing in a construction deal, but we've priced out all the furniture. We've priced out all the construction. We have our plans done 100%. That's a competitive advantage as opposed to like a guy that, yeah, like I was pitched on a deal recently. A lot of you guys know this person maybe. And I was like, there's no way you're building that for like it. You're like, you're showing me a rendering, but it's not going to look like that. Like, it's just, there's never going to cost. It's never going to work out to have that make sense. It wasn't the whole project. It was like one aspect of the project, but that is like a red flag because it's going to have to be value engineered significantly. And then what's it going to look like? How is that going to impact the end game?
Do you have time for one more question?
One more question. Let's do it.
So something that we're working through right now. And I know you, I'd mentioned this before and we hadn't like dove into it deeply. On competitive advantages, I have an architect partner at The Attention. They have a really good track record for developing resorts above our ADR, but at like a set development cost per square foot. One of the things that we're doing, both to mitigate some of our soft cost expenditure up front and also to have alignment from him on the project, is we're allowing him to take some of his fees as LP funds for later in the project. And he's happy to do so because he really believes in the vision. When we talk about like partner alignment, when it comes down to raising capital for investors down the line, is this something that's like compelling or worrying? Because there are a lot of partners that I have like in construction management that are happy to put their own skin in the game from an equity perspective at an LP basis, not a GP basis, co-GP basis.
I don't think that's a red flag at all, because in my view, it just brings down the overall cost of the project. So it's not a red flag. It's kind of like a freebie, actually. It's a validation of the project from someone who is not investing for a living, but related to the investment world. What is most important there is you have very clear expectations of what that say and what say he has, right? So he's going to roll in as an LP. Well, he's an LP. So like when I cut like his fantasy idea of a, a pool or something, then he can't really complain about it. But on the flip side, he also should be motivated to design something that fits within the budget so that he can make money too. Because ultimately, he's not investing to have a freebie in the project. He's investing to get a return on his capital too, because, you know, there's a time loss as well. So I think you just have to have clear alignment around, sure, you can invest, but you're still an LP. Like at the end of the day, I'm calling the shots here. Mm-hmm. And you're going to help me get it done.
Is there any risk to do that, something similar with construction partners? Because I've been figuring out the right incentives between, you know.
It happens all the time. I know a friend of mine. Well, I'll give you two. I mean, a friend of mine builds multifamily and their construction partner and investor, like the family office of the construction firm, invests in the deal. So I think there's great alignment. But they still fight over change orders and stuff. But at the end of the day, there's like, everyone knows that like, we want to do what's best for the project. So I don't think there's any issue there, but there shouldn't be a GP in the project unless you really want them to be a GP in the project. Everyone knows what that means. There's, if you know the Pendry Hotel in West Hollywood, that was built by, it's being foreclosed upon right now. So it's like not a great investment, but that was built by a firm called AECOM. Mm-hmm. And AECOM also invests in the project. So it even happens on major projects because, you know, that's how they're getting business too. But if you had the opportunity to choose between a shitty GC or a shitty project manager that's willing to invest in the project and a good one that's not, I'd always go the good one. So don't tie it to anything like that.
Yeah, I've had some people, some construction firms haven't been willing to do LP investment, but they have been figuring out how they could set an incentive against a target IRR like years out. And like that, I haven't quite ironed out. Have you ever seen?
Yeah, that's tough successful? Because they don't have anything to do. You know, they don't have anything to do with that. Like, what if they deliver a great construction project on time and on your budget? But then you're like a bad hotel operator. You know, create this resort in Mexico, and then instead of putting in a great Mexican restaurant, you're like, oh, I want to put a Chinese restaurant in there, and no one comes to your hotel because no one wants to eat Chinese food in Mexico. Like, that's not on them, that's on you. So I think that's a little bit tougher.
Yeah, it's like they've come from like a multifamily background where they like set a target for like unit sale.
The better thing to do is if they... You can't negotiate this up front. It has to be at the end, but it's like a shared savings clause. So if they build the project for, you know, $100,000 less than they said, you know, maybe you guys split that 60-40 or 50-50. But you can't obviously negotiate that in the beginning. That's like, you're ready to sign on the dotted line. Hey, by the way, can you guys, you know, try and build this for less than $1 million? If you do, I'll split whatever savings is 50-50 with you.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. I know we should wrap up here, but it'd be interesting in future if we could like deep dive on incentive structures for like construction firms, because like I've heard, like I know in some markets where like material costs like are rising a lot, like sometimes it makes sense for you to close the budget and agree at the front when they're starting. But I know that there's other dynamics like the shared cost savings. And so curious how.
Yeah, by the way, you know, we can talk about this forever. We'll do another call on this, but like, In your Mexico, so it's a little bit different, but like even on like a smaller project, you know, the reality is if you agree on a firm bid, okay, and the guy clearly made a mistake and like he forgot to, I don't know, include like the pool or something, like he's not going to eat $100,000 for your pool and just lose money and fund it most likely. So. And you also probably, if it's like a genuine mistake, like don't necessarily want to like screw someone or whatever. So there's always going to be a negotiation. Mm-hmm. Just like during COVID, there were negotiations when building materials started rising because these subs were like, well, listen, I'll just walk off the job then and I'll go bankrupt. So I'm not just going to like, you know, I didn't buy the air handler unit a year ago, maybe like I should have. And sure, you would say that. But here's the situation we're in. So I'm just going to walk off the job and you could sue me, or, you know, I'll give it to you at my cost or something. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's not good to like fight over stuff like that. So yeah. We'll talk about it in the future. Thanks for the time, everyone. It was a lot of fun. This is a good one.
Hey everyone, it's Jake here. Thanks again for joining me on this conversation. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Lastly, don't forget to follow me on Twitter @JayWorzak. I'll see you in the next episode.
Jake Worzak is the founder and CEO of Dove Hill Capital Management. All opinions expressed by Jake and his guests are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Dove Hill Capital Management. This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not reflect or represent real estate, financial, or investment advice.